Welcome to Our Missouri, a podcast about the people, places, culture, and history of the 114 counties and independent city of St. Louis that comprise the great state of Missouri. Each episode focuses on a topic related to the state, ranging from publications about Missouri's history to current projects undertaken by organizations to preserve and promote local institutions. The Our Missouri podcast is recorded at the Center for Missouri Studies in Columbia and is generously provided to you by the State Historical Society of Missouri. And now, here's your host, Sean Ross.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, whatever you are tuning in to listen to the Our Missouri podcast. My name is Sean Ross, and we guide as we explore the memories, moments, and misfortunes from Our Missouri. Welcome back to our series, On the Bookshelf, which looks at new publications on Missouri history. Our guest today is Susan Croce Kelly. She serves as the managing editor of Ozarks Watch magazine, which is part of Missouri State University's Ozark Studies Institute, and she is the author of several books, including Route 66, The Highway and Its People, and Father of Route 66, The Story of Cy Avery. If her name sounds familiar, she was previously a guest on Our Missouri in Season 2, Episode 21, talking about the life and legacy of Cy Avery. Today, she joins us to talk about her new book, Newspaper Woman of the Ozarks, The Life and Times of Lucille Morris Upton. If you're in the Columbia area on March 12th, be sure to come by the Center for Missouri Studies to hear Susan talk about her new book as well, as part of the History on Elm series. Welcome to Our Missouri, Susan.
I'm really glad to be here. Thank you, Sean.
Now, Susan, tell me a little bit about the origin of this book project. Where does it come from?
In a lot of ways, I think it was just ordained since I was born. Lucille Morris Upton was my grandfather's sister, and she was a looming figure in my childhood. I was kind of afraid of her, but she was a newspaper reporter down in Springfield. I grew up in St. Louis. I didn't really know her. She was kind of intimidating when I was a little girl, so I didn't know her. But as it happened, I moved to Springfield and joined the staff of the News Leader when I was in my 20s. And that was the paper that Lucille had worked for so long. She was already long retired, but she was still doing a weekly history column. And this was pre-internet days. She would walk into the newspaper office and she would have articles, she would have her column, and then she would have probably an article about the Greene County Historical Society, where she was a member, and she was passionate about regional history. And occasionally she would walk in with another article and tell managing editor Dale Freeman that they'd missed it and really should put this article in the paper. And as far as I knew, Dale always did. I mean, she'd been a good reporter, and even in her 80s, Lucille was pretty intimidating. So that's when I got to know her, and we got to be friends. I would go over to her house, and I'd listen to stories of her past and her colleagues, and I got really interested in, well, I loved newspapering, and I got really interested in the world of newspapering before I was there. Then, of course, after she died, I decided I should write a book about her. And she died in 1992, and I was living in Chicago. And in 1995, I came to Springfield and interviewed a whole lot of people who had known her and worked with her. That included Dale Freeman, who I mentioned, other colleagues at the newspaper, Ann Dodson, who was closer to Lucille's age, then several people my age, Mike O'Brien and Cheryl Capages, and a couple of other people, and then Gordon McCann, who was a real history buff and a good buddy of Lucille's. And he's also recorded lots and lots of Ozark music and was worth interviewing just in his own right. And an attorney named John Halston, who was another one of her history colleagues, I guess. And he, in particular, was interested in saving the Nathan Boone house in Ash Grove. He'd grown up in Ash Grove. Nathan Boone was Daniel Boone's youngest son. He was part of the Boone's Lick salt lick manufacturing. And he was a surveyor, he'd been an Indian fighter and a peacemaker in the West. So he was pretty significant. And his house, his big house in Ash Grove, was just falling apart. Lucille and John and other people were really worried about it. Today it's a state historic site, thanks to their work, and really an interesting place. So I did that, and then one thing led to another. I had a job and a child, and then 20 years ago, my husband retired and we moved to the Lake of the Ozarks, and I started taking trips to Springfield to talk to more people, not only about Lucille, but about Betty Love, who was a photographer in the initial group of photographers inducted into the Missouri Photography Hall of Fame, and nationally known as well. She was a pioneer in color newspaper photography. And for about 15 years, I think, the newspaper had sent Lucille and Betty out together. And they became kind of the dynamic duo. If I say Lucille Morris Upton to people of a certain age in Springfield, they say, and Betty. So I heard a lot of stories about Betty. She was a character. And she had been at the paper when I was there. But again, I was pretty intimidated by Betty. She was tough. Over the years, I talked to Bob Linder, who was a photographer and became later head of the photo department and head of the audiovisual department at MSU, and one of several women, mutual friends of Betty's and Lucille's, and again, Dale Freeman, who was the managing editor of the paper, because he had this overview that a lot of the rest of us didn't have. And that was in 95, and that stuff sat. And then during COVID, I said, okay, now it's time. And Lucille had left her, Lucille thought quite a lot of herself, as it turned out. And she had saved tons of papers. She had love letters from an old boyfriend who had wanted to be a newspaper reporter. So he was very significant in her life. And she made a ton of speeches, and she wrote them all down and kept them in notebooks. So in the book where I quote Lucille, those are her words. They really are her words because she wrote them down. And she had a very dear friend named Dosha Carroll at the paper, but left after World War II to go with the U.S. Army for the Japanese occupation of Japan. And she was an editor over there for a year, I think, came back to the newspaper, and then later left again because she had fallen in love with Japan, and she ended up with a career as the editor of Japan Airlines magazine. And she was living in San Francisco. And over all those years, Lucille and Dosha wrote letters, and Lucille kept copies of her letters to Dosha. There were only a few from Dosha. But again, it's Lucille's words about what was going on when the newspaper went on strike, the printers went on strike at the newspaper. When the newspaper building burned down in 1947, she got on the bus to go to work, and the bus driver said, the paper burned down. And that's how all the day people found out, because it had burned in the night. But lots of local commentary about that, about what was going on. And Lucille had pretty strong opinions about people, so that was also part of the letters. One of the people that she had very mixed opinions about was Vance Randolph, the famous folklorist, for a variety of reasons that are in the book. I thought it was funny, but at the time, I guess it wasn't funny for either one of them. So that was the information. And then when she died, she left all that material to the State Historical Society. And at the time, in the 90s, you took all of Lucille's papers and microfilmed them. And then you gave all the papers back to the family. And as I did my research over the years, and then not during COVID, but around that time, when I would be talking to relatives, they would say, oh, I've got a box of her stuff in the basement. You want it? So I ended up with probably not all, but again, a whole lot of this material, which was fabulous during COVID because I couldn't go anyplace. After that, after the book was accepted for publication and we were down the line, I gave the original material then to the local library in Springfield, where they have amassed a wonderful collection of newspaper history, photographs by Betty Love and Bob Linder, the two people that I mentioned, but then lots of other material that have come from people of Lucille's era at the newspaper. So that seemed like be a good place to put for her second body of work to be collected. And then, like I said, I wrote it during COVID and submitted it to the University of Arkansas Press. I figured an Ozark book should be published by the University of Arkansas Press, and they thought so too, happily, and came out late last fall.
Talk a little bit about that source material. You mentioned the letters, obviously, going through those. I guess a two-part question to that. One is, what are your genuine reactions to reading these letters from way back when and her thoughts on things? But also, are you reading the newspaper as well, kind of accompanying what she is saying in writing of her own, but also what she's saying in the newspapers as well?
Yes, thank goodness for newspapers.com, because I could look up anything she said, you know, and localize it, and that really was very useful. I got a huge kick out of reading the letters. The boyfriend, his name was Homer Garland, and he was from around Warrensburg, and he was teaching at Dadeville Schools when Lucille became a teacher. And he said he wanted to save his money and go out west and become a journalist, a newspaper reporter. And his dad had been an editor of a union newspaper in Springfield, Springfield was a very union town when the railroads were there, a lot of other things were going on. High talked to her about newspapering. And then he left for World War II. He was in the military, but never sent overseas, and got a job ultimately with the Tulsa Democrat, I think. Not the World, a smaller okay. Tulsa paper. And from there, he would come back and visit Lucille, and he would also send her letters about his passionate, never-ending love and what he thought of newspapers. As far as his love was concerned, he told one of her other great nieces that he never felt like he had enough money to support a wife. I don't have any of her letters, so I don't know. But there was one letter who said, well, you know, clearly we don't have a future together. And then the next letter said, oh, forgive me. And I guess it's all the same, you know. But I've got pieces of two of his letters about newspapers that I just think is classic. One of the letters, which is, you have to be of a certain age to really resonate with this. But he wrote to her, he said, did you ever consider what would happen if we were without newspapers, even for a day? He said, businesses would be partially paralyzed and the whole country would be greatly upset as if there was no bread. And that's the way newspapers were. The whole world depended on them. And in a region like even central Missouri, and certainly the Ozarks, you read the newspaper to find out what was going on 40 miles away, because people didn't travel through those hills. So they really were very important. Other times, Garland wasn't quite so high-minded. And here's one of his other letters. He said, well, we're having a very dull time now insofar as big local news is concerned. A few deaths, conventions, minor accidents, and that sort of thing. But one of these days or nights, there'll be a suicide and a train wreck and a killing all at once. Then business will pick up. So he was high-minded, but he was also a little bit cynical about newspapering. Like I said, she was a teacher, and after they broke up, she taught maybe another year or two. And then she decided that she needed a change and she needed an adventure. And it turned out that the town of Roswell, New Mexico, was looking for teachers from the East. And Lucille signed on and was accepted, and then she rode what they called the teacher train out west. So I guess this was pretty common. And I don't know what that evokes in your mind, but every time I say it, I see the old Western movies with the stagecoach pulling in and the very prim schoolmarm getting out, and then she falls in love with the cowboy and saves the town. Those two things didn't happen to Lucille. And actually, Roswell wasn't so much Wild West as a big farming community. It was right near West Texas, and they called it the Texas part of New Mexico. So it was a different kind of being out west. But during that year that she taught in Roswell, she decided she really did want to become a newspaper reporter, that sounded much more fun than being a teacher. So she was going to come back and go to the University of Missouri J School, which was about 15 years old at that time, I think, and then she would become a reporter. And at the end of the term, there was another woman from Missouri there, and she hitched a ride with her friend to go home, to ride home, but they decided that they would take a side trip to Denver before they came back to Missouri. And once they got to Denver, the friend went sightseeing, and Lucille, with her new goal in mind, thought, well, let me see what happens. And she went to the office of the Denver Post, the big newspaper in town, and asked for a job. They said they didn't have anything, but they said, why don't you go try the Denver Express across town? It's a smaller paper, see what happens. And so she went to the Express, and she told the editor, she said she really wanted a job, even though I have no experience and I've never been to journalism school. And what I knew of Lucille in her old age, I'm sure that it just came out like, you know. And he said, that's great. He said, I like to train my own people. And even when I was young, I heard that. The editor of the Denver Express hired her on the spot. And she became a newspaper reporter. In those days, many women who joined newspaper staffs started out as sob sisters. That was the lowest of the low. It was a combination of advice to the lovelorn and writing these heart-rending stories full of emotion and pathos about orphans and terrible situations that had happened. And It was maybe not the most fun, but it was a starting place for a lot of women. At the Express, the Advice to the Lovelorn column was under the name of Cynthia Gray. So Lucille wasn't Lucille, she was Cynthia Gray. And over the course of the year, she answered letters from young women about how they should start their careers, what they should do, what to do about straying boyfriends and husbands. You know, occasionally she would throw in a recipe that somebody wanted. And one time there was even, you know, if you need a puppy, there's somebody with a dog that's just had a bunch of puppies at such and such a place in Denver. So she really got into it. But one of the things that she talked about, the women, young women asked her, was what to do about a career. And she basically told them, figure out what you want to do and just do it. You know, work hard, and it's up to you. And that was pretty much Lucille's attitude about everything she did, is just get on with it. But she was the Advice of the Lovelorn columnist. And then she began to do occasional more city desk kind of really reporting. She was sent to the State House every once in a while. And then one Sunday she was at the paper, and the editor looked around and called her over, and he said, President Harding is coming to town. Why don't you go over and see what's going on? And so, armed with newspaper credentials, she went through the police lines to get to where the president was. And she said all of her life, that was just a highlight of her career. And she talked about it over time, but it wasn't enough to keep her in Denver. She was really sick of being the Advice to the Lovelorn columnist. So she looked around, found a regular reporting job in El Paso, which wasn't too far from where she'd been in Roswell. So she quit her job in Denver and then went south to El Paso. When she got to El Paso, she was accepted as a reporter who had another job, did stories for the city desk, and worked with an amazing number of people. Back in the 1920s, which is when this was, she got her job in Denver in 1923 and her job in El Paso in 1924. But El Paso was really a crossing place through the mountains between Mexico and the U.S. and the East and the West. And there were a lot of people who came to El Paso because of the weather. There were lots of sanatoriums for people to get well from tuberculosis and dry out from heavy-duty jobs with a lot of drinking, as one reporter put it. It was also just across the border in those prohibition days from beer and wine and everything else. And the people at the El Paso Times had been everywhere and done everything. A lot of them had come from the East Coast and were moving west. Some of them were from the West Coast and moving east. Two individuals who later married, he became a journalism professor at Stanford. And she went back east and worked for the Detroit Free Press and I think the New York World Telegram. And then they later married and she was out west. But she got involved in covering the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. And I think that team was put up for a Pulitzer Prize, according to Lucille. I tried to research that, and I'm not positive. But anyway, it was people like that. Another one of the men became the editor of the Los Angeles Times. And through a person, a fellow that she met in El Paso, she got a job with the International News Service in London. So she quit her job in El Paso after a year, came home to see her family, and as happens in the Ozarks, one thing led to another, and she just stayed in the Ozarks. And she tried to get a job in the big papers in St. Louis and Kansas City. They both turned her down because she was a woman. And again, knowing Lucille, I suspect that she was disappointed, but I suspect she also thought it was their loss. She had been doing feature stories for him while she was in Springfield trying to figure out what to do, which was kind of ironic. And then she got a job in 1926 at the Springfield Leader, which was the oldest paper in town. And she stayed in Springfield and working at Springfield newspapers till 1964 when she retired. And as I said, this history column that she had for 20 more years, that she was actually working for the newspaper in one form or another until the mid-80s. Let me tell you about some of the other women that Lucille ran into or heard of. One of them, of course, was Betty Love. They worked together, like I said, for about 15 years. And they covered lots of historic sites. Part of the time was during the Civil War centennial. And Betty was a photographer and Lucille was a history buff. So those were perfect for Sunday big feature spreads. But they also covered at least one murder. They covered a bank robbery. They were, which I think is a great story, they were at a party with a bunch of women, and the newspaper city desk tracked him down at the party, called him and said, there's been a bank robbery over in Republic. Go cover it. And Elizabeth McCain, who was a mutual friend of theirs and who I knew, told me later, she said, as they left, Lucille said, we may get shot, but we're out of here. Then the story picks up when they got to Republic. The police had the two of the bank robbers in hand, and the third one is in the backseat of a police car. And Lucille went to talk to the policeman, and Betty leaned into the police car with her camera, and she leaned in, and the robber looked up and looked at her, and he gave her a big smile, and he said, why, Betty, you came to take my picture. She was really well, they were both well known, but Betty was a photographer, so she was really well known. And as it turned out, the two robbers who had failed miserably in their bank robbery, as it turned out, but they went to jail. This guy was so drunk, he couldn't even remember if he'd driven the car or not, and they let him off. And a lot of the things that Betty and Lucille did were like that. The story of the two of them was much more memorable than the story of whatever they wrote about, even though the facts would be in the paper. A lot of times Lucille would talk about their role in whatever was going on. Another time, Lucille was at her Historical Society meeting, and a fellow named Marvin Tong gave a talk about a little cemetery on the banks of the James River that was going to be covered up as Table Rock Lake was formed. And Lucille went to work the next day and said, Betty and I need to go out and see that cemetery because it's Joseph Philibert's burial ground. And he was a French fur trader who was probably the first white settler in that part of the Ozarks. Of course, they got the assignment, and Mr. Tong drove them out. But when they got to where the cemetery was across the river, the bridge had been washed out. It was a long way around, and there were a couple of fishermen on the bank, and they said, you know, you can wade across. So Betty and Lucille decided that they would wade across. Lucille wrote in the article that it was because Betty wanted to take her pictures. But I suspect Lucille was just as determined. And she took off her shoes and hiked up her skirt, walked across the river, and Betty took a picture of her, of course. And then Betty took off her shoes and rolled up her pants legs, and she waded across the river. And they were pretty soggy as they took the pictures of the little graves, and Lucille wrote down who the people were and so forth. And then as they turned around and started back, I doubt they were as enthusiastic as they had been in the beginning. But just then, and as Lucille wrote, just like in the movies, around the corner a boat came, and they were saved. And there was a young couple in the boat. And again, they waved and asked for help. And the young woman in the boat said, you're Betty Love. And turned out Betty had taken the young woman's picture years before when she'd run a scholarship. And again, Betty was remembered. So they pulled over, and the two wet women got onto a bunch of camping gear and things like that and got ferried back across the river and got out. And the rest is history. It's every bit of it is in the old newspaper spread. Picture of Lucille in the river, picture of Betty in the river. Lucille took to carrying her own camera because she didn't always trust Betty to take the pictures that she wanted. Of course, hers was just like a little Brownie camera. Pictures of the people in the boat, and also pictures of the cemetery. But everything that happened, Lucille wrote down, and then they verified it with Betty's pictures. So that was one of their most notorious escapades. But things like that happened to the two of them, and they made good copy and wrote good stories. But over the years, where Lucille was out west was a really good place to be a newspaper woman. When she got to Denver, there were lots of newspaper women, and they were pretty important. One, who was no longer a newspaper woman when Lucille got there, had written for the newspapers and covered the 1908 Democratic Convention when it came to Denver, and then was elected to the state legislature. And another woman had been a sob sister, and a lot of the times the word sob sister was also kind of synonymous with a stunt reporter. And she had been in San Francisco and faked fainting on the streets so that she could do an expose story on the emergency hospital and how they treated people. And the Denver women, there was a woman, I don't know that she was still there, but had started a newspaper in 1876 in order to push for women's rights and the vote. And actually Colorado gave women the right to vote in 1893. So it was a different mindset out west. And when she got to El Paso, I mentioned the people she worked with, but about a decade before she was there, there was a woman named Peggy Hull, who had been a reporter at the Times. And she wrote stories about the military and the forays into Mexico with chasing Pancho Villa, the bandit. And then when World War I came along, Peggy talked her editor into letting her go with the troops from the El Paso area over to France. She was not an accredited war correspondent, but she went. And she wrote what they called little stories about what was going on in France, you know, what it was like in the camps, in the training camps, what Paris was like during the war and things like that, became very popular. Her articles were picked up all over the country. And she came back after, I don't know, less than a year, I gathered. And they welcomed her with a parade and everybody, because she had gotten to be so well known. And I think Peggy stayed at the paper just a few months, and then through her connections with the military, she became the first woman accredited war correspondent. So that was a big deal, and she stayed with the military covering Siberia and then was in the Pacific during World War II. So, you know, Lucille had really good role models who took no prisoner to do what they did.
That's an impressive list of accomplishments there. Talk a little bit about, we've kind of introduced her in a lot of ways, but talk a little bit about her early life, you know, where she came from leading up in many ways to that extraordinary career.
Okay. I can go back a little ways even. Lucille was born in Dadeville, which at the time was a thriving farm community. It had hotels, a movie theater, doctors, bars, livery stables, the whole bit. Just as a matter of interest, I have been back and forth into Dadeville over the years, and right before the book came out, I thought, I really need to know what's in Dadeville. And today, there's a school, there's a couple of stores, there's a cemetery, and I'm sure people from Dadeville will say there's other things, but there's not even any remnants of this thriving little farm town that was pretty well documented. She was born in Dadeville, the daughter of a man named Albert Morris, and her mother was Vita Wilson Morris. Both of them had graduated from the Dadeville Academy, which was a high school, and her father had been the valedictorian. And she had two younger brothers, and her father died when she was nine. So she grew up, her mother never remarried, and Lucille grew up knowing she was going to have to take care of herself. So as she told people, she said, so I thought about being in the only career I knew anything about, which was teaching, which she did. She started teaching when she was 19. In those days, you could get teaching courses in high school, and you could be approved to be a grade school teacher very young. And that's where she met Homer Garland. Then the rest I kind of explained. Side story, but kind of interesting. Her father died, I think they decided it maybe was stomach cancer. They weren't sure, but he was ill for quite a while. And he was worried that his children wouldn't remember him. So he told Vita, he said, just bury me out in the yard, because then they can come and see my grave and they'll pay attention to me. And the family lived on the corner of her grandparents' farm. And the big house was on the farm and the little house. So there was property around, there was farmland around. And Vita, after he died, got in touch with the Masonic Lodge and gave them a couple of acres of land to put a cemetery in their front yard. And the Masons, you know, there's a fence around the cemetery. This is a cemetery that's still in Dadeville, so I know where the farmhouse was. And there was a gate so the kids could go out their front door and go through the gate, and then their father was buried just on the other side. And that's where Lucille is today, along with, you know, her mother and her grandparents and one of her brothers and sister-in-law. So it still is kind of a family cemetery, but it's a community cemetery. But I think that's kind of a cool story. Mm-hmm. Just bury me out in the front yard.
In going through the book, what are some major themes that she really touched on overall in the book? What are some, you could say, moments in her life or some major subject matters that you address in the book?
I think, in my mind, there's three themes in the book. One, of course, is the basic biography of Lucille's life from 1898 to 1992 and her legacy of historic preservation, and as a newspaper reporter. And I think that's what I set out to write about. And then Lucille was important in her community, important in her world, but she wasn't of great significance in the bigger world. And I knew in the beginning that for my book to have any real resonance, I had to talk about what was going on in the world around Lucille, the world that she dealt with. And so it's also a story of the changing Ozarks, during the 20th century. And there was a lot of change, you know, from a backwater that was kind of isolated to, you know, communication came in, roads came in, and the paved roads came in the 20s. And then during the 50s and 60s, country music and the Ozark Jubilee television show, which was a nationally broadcast TV show. And then in the 60s, Silver Dollar City, and it became a destination for tourists. And of course, all along, the Ozarks was a big fishing and hunting destination for people from all over. So that story is pretty important, I think. And then when I finished the book and went back and looked at the manuscript, it was, oh my gosh, everything Lucille did, all of her life, there were more women there before her doing that, which really startled me. You know, nobody told me that there were all these women out there in the 1920s doing their own thing and working very hard at it and being very successful. And I think that's a kind of an undercurrent to the whole book.
What do you hope that readers take away as they go through the book?
Well, I hope they like Lucille. That's the main thing. You know, I hope they come away and say, that was a good read. You know, I really like that woman. I gave a talk last week. I was really surprised at the reaction. I've given a bunch of talks, and to a large extent, the audience has been people who knew Lucille or had heard of Lucille and people who go to lectures. But there were some young women in the audience the other night, and they were blown away by the message of feminine activists, but not in the term of activists for feminism, but activists in terms of I'm going to do this job and I'm just going out and doing it. And afterwards, they stayed and asked a lot of questions. And then one of them said, well, I work at Missouri State. You think you could come over there and talk to other young women? And that kind of surprised me. But as I told you, I was surprised. So it shouldn't surprise me that women a generation younger than me or two generations younger than me were also surprised. And I think maybe that's going to be more important in the long run than I ever considered.
Thank you very much for joining us today, Susan.
It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the R Missouri Podcast. If you would like to learn more about the podcast, including past and future episodes, information about guests and upcoming events, please visit our website at shsmo.org/our-Missouri.